Hello there, this is Bane. When I'm not out on the streets of Gotham hunting the Batman, I find myself listening to Part-Time Fanboy on a regular basis. Be sure to check out Part-Time Fanboy at www.parttimefanboy.com for somewhat weekly podcasts and reviews about various fanboy-related subjects. Also be sure to like them on Facebook and follow them on the Twitter. Do it now, or I'll have to do something awful to your spine.
About your backgrounds. I mean, you can, because I know that maybe some people might not exactly know who you are. I mean, if you want to start with Robert, what are your comic book backgrounds, your film background, if you want to start with that?
Sure. I had a very eclectic film career, and it continues to be eclectic. Mm-hmm. From, you know, being a kid and producing Surf Nazis Must Die to directing a lot of features through the 90s, with mainly for you know, like kids type films, things like Kids at the Round Table and Frankenstein and Me, and getting to work with some cool people like, you know, Ryan Gosling, Alicia Cuthbert, Burt Reynolds, and relocated back to the East Coast. Just wanted to raise my kids back here, and I like it back here, but still work in Hollywood mostly now, writing, although I do a lot of, I'm just finishing up a feature-length documentary called "We'll Just Say That Stuff Will Rot Your Brain," which is about how, in fact, you guys ran some coverage on it, about how when they released the classic horror movies to TV in the 50s and 60s, how it kind of transformed popular culture.
Uh-huh.
All these kids that love it. So just, it's a very, very varied career. Comic-wise, Neil Vokes and I were friends, and it was funny, I would have found it logically easier to raise money to make a movie than I would have thought that anybody would ever let me do comics. I was just a comic fanatic. I loved comics.
Uh-huh.
And Todd Livingston and I had come up with the idea for what eventually became our second book, not our first one, was called The Wicked West. And Neil, you just finished up, I think, Superman Adventures.
Yeah, right? they had just ended the series.
And it was before you did Parliament of Justice. And we were at a convention, actually a film convention, just friends hanging out, drinking at the bar. And Neil said, "What are you guys working on?" And we told him, and he goes, "I want to draw that."
Uh-huh.
We were just sort of like blown away that anybody, and you know, and it just kind of went from there. And just, I just love comics. I love the medium, and I'm just really grateful that I get to work in it with so many good people.
Oh, that's great. Allow me to geek out for a second, because Neil, I actually was a big fan of that Superman Adventures book. I really, really liked it. I'm a big Superman fan in general, and I thought that those were some of the better Superman stories told. I mean, even though it was kind of considered a kiddie book, I guess, by most people, I really thought that the stories and the art in that book were some of the better Superman stories in maybe, what, like the past, I don't know how long has it been, I would say like 10 years?
Yeah, that was fun. I heard that a lot when I was doing Superman Adventures, along with the various other people that worked on it, like Terry Austin on the inks and such, is that everybody that came up and talked about it said, you know, these stories in the animated book are just so much better than so many of the present-day Superman.
Well, you know, Christian, do you remember the one? I remember the one he did about Krypto.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Which I think I have a page from, an original page. That story was just wonderful.
Ty Templeton wrote that.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, that was such a great story.
That was also one of my... In fact, I recently, just like 3 days ago before I came to the show, I had a fan write me and say, "Do you have any pages left from that one with Krypto?" And I said, "I'm gone." But uh-huh. There were some of those stories were just fantastic. I really enjoyed the ones with that Mark Evener wrote, because he included the Mr. Miracle.
Yeah.
And Big Barda. And I loved working on those because obviously, because Kirby.
Yeah, of course. Kirby's absolutely fantastic. I mean, I don't have to say that to anybody out there. But what about a little bit more of your history, Neil? Can you go a little bit more into depth besides the Superman stuff?
Well, I started comic-wise back in around 84.
Uh-huh.
So I've been doing this now about 28 years.
Wow.
And I started with a small company called Kimiko Comics in Pennsylvania.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they had just started. That was Matt Wagner.
Yeah, yeah.
Chinata and those fellas. They had just come out of college. They started their own company. And I had sent out my samples to many, many different people with a friend of mine who was an inker. Mm-hmm. And Rich Rankin, and he and I weren't getting any response because, again, our stuff really wasn't that great illustration-wise. The other problem was if you send any samples to DC or Marvel and you don't do their character, they won't look at it.
Mm-hmm.
They basically feel that if you don't draw our characters, you just can't draw.
Uh-huh.
So I was very, very disappointed about that, but the smaller companies responded nicely. Joe Staton was art director at... Pacific Comics, and he sent back a lovely response. He gave me notes and he made little sketches and things for me, and it helped me a lot. Uh-huh. And we met people like Marshall Rogers and that at conventions, and they gave us all sorts of pointers. But this small company, Kimiko, liked this one short story we did. They took it and put it in their little primer, Kimiko Primer comic, all this new talent, which virtually the whole company was new talent.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing led to another. We became friends with the guys. They signed us a book they were going to do. I did about 3 months worth, about 90 total pages. They ended up not doing the book, but it gave me 3 months of work they paid for, and I needed that on the job training anyway.
Yeah.
And then they got the Robotech license, and we got a choice of one of the 3 books they were doing. Then after about 2 years, my buddy Rich and I decided to self-publish a book called Eagle, which was kind of a martial arts, magical kind of thing. He was like Doctor Strange with a sword.
Mm-hmm.
And we did that as a black and white book because the Turtles had come out, and everybody was doing black and white books at that point. And they were selling like hotcakes.
Mm-hmm.
And our first issue of Eagle sold over 40,000 copies.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. We did that for a few issues. Of course, it went steadily down from there, but on the average, we were selling about 10,000-15,000 copies. And then the black and white thing, as all these things in the industry go, everybody just overdid it. So it just fizzled, except for guys like the Turtles.
Uh-huh.
And we had to cancel the book. But I moved on and did all sorts of other work for hire things in those years. I worked at DC, Marvel, Dark Horse. We did stuff in Image later. And lots and lots and lots of different things. Tarzan, Kongorilla, Jurassic Park. I worked on all sorts of kinds of books, and it was fun. It was a great experience. I learned a lot. But the most recent at that time, which would have been some years ago, now about 10 years ago, was the Superman Adventures book.
Mm-hmm.
And I had gone in to get the Batman Adventure book. I really wanted to draw Batman real bad. And my agent tried to get it for me, but they said, we're starting the Superman animated one, too. Would you be interested? And I said, I'm not as interested, but sure, what the hell? And it turned out I had a great time drawing it. And because I think literally the first comic I remember reading was a Superman comic. It was probably about 4, mm-hmm. maybe 5, and I probably read it in a barber shop, Tony's barber shop. So it was like destiny. Eventually, I even got around to drawing Superman. And then that book got canceled.
Yeah.
So I was kind of floundering a little bit, and Mike Oeming came to me and said, because he was a young guy that I had kind of mentored at the beginning of his career, and he had this idea called Parliament of Justice, and it was this kind of starts out like an animated thing and gets really dark and really violent. And I didn't want to do it. I turned him down. I said, no, this isn't me, because I just came off of Superman Adventures, so uh-huh. It was a whole different kind of book. But then he changed my mind. I sat down, I did it, and I suddenly got noticed by people. It's one thing to draw, say, Superman. Mm-hmm. It's really a geeky, wonderful thing. But you're one of 500 guys that drew Superman.
Yeah.
And this guy came along and he said, here's this project, let's do this. And now it's like, this is Neil Vokes's project.
Yeah.
Guys like Mark Wheatley, whose work I respect, came up and said, you found your voice After 20 years, you found your voice.
Wow. So is that in trade, Parliament of Justice? Or?
Yes.
It was a one-shot.
Yeah, it was
from
a
one-shot.
Image. It was one.
Oh.
Standalone graphic novella.
Yeah,
it's awesome.
It ends, it's just beginning, middle, and an end, and that's it.
Oh, that sounds great.
That was around the time also that Bob and I started talking about these things. But I was introduced to Bob, as I told somebody this weekend, at this convention we met at, which I believe was the 93 Famous Monsters Con.
No.
It wasn't that one?
No.
It was 90...
I think it was 90...
well, it was
95,
in that. Something. It was in that area. Mm-hmm. And he was introduced to me as a filmmaker who loved comics, and I was introduced to him as a comic book maker who loved films. And it just kind of meshed. And we were like fast friends within one day of that weekend, I think.
Oh, that's great.
It was, and we just started talking. So he showed me the script for Black Forest. We talked about Wicked West, this other idea they had. And I said, you know, Black Forest would make a hell of a comic book. Would you like to do it? And Bob, I never did any comic books before. You know, what do we do? Mm-hmm. So we just worked out all the little details. I sat down and drew that thing, and I loved every second of it. And did it kind of the same style as I did Parliament, in the black and white ink wash style. Mm-hmm. And one thing led to another, and we've been doing projects ever since.
And the weird thing was, and I swear, like, it sounds like there was totally a plan. And, you know, like, you always hear from people, they go, oh, do you do comics to get movies made? Man, if I do comics to get movies made, somebody needs to hit me upside the head with a fork. Because it's a lot easier just to go get movies made, you know, in my experience. Than
really? Because that's the question I had for you, Robert, because you had just mentioned saying that it was really hard for you to get, or that getting people to let you do comics or do comics. I mean, why is that? What's the difference? I mean,
I didn't ask. I mean, I was too stupid to ask, you know? And the oddest thing about it is, and Neil will back you up, and I swear, you know, let me preface this by saying, you know, I loved Pink Floyd when I was a kid, and it always seemed so brilliant and smart to me, and I thought that they had this really elaborate plan. Uh-huh. And then I read a book about them and discovered there was no plan at all. They were just kind of like banging around in the universe, and things worked out. Well, if you look back at the comic thing, you'll think that there was this plan where there was none.
Uh-huh.
Funny enough, I had for a few years, I had become really enamored of things like, I wasn't reading comics so much anymore. I was still reading books like Hellblazer, you know, things that I really liked, or Preacher or something. But I was in Astro City. I was a nut for Astro City, and I'm big, you know, I was a big fan of Kurtz. But I had discovered like comic book artists, you know, the Tomorrow's book, and I started becoming sort of obsessed with how comics were made and the history of them. So when Neil actually kind of had to yank my chain pretty early on, because he's like, look, you know, I appreciate what you're trying to do. You don't have to do that with me. You don't, because I was like, look, do we need to plan this for this, or do we have to plan that for that? You know, almost like really full script, kind of like you're writing for British artists or something, where you have to get
right.
So meticulous.
Yeah, like Alan Moore.
But I wasn't doing it because I wasn't trying to be a control freak. I had just so absorbed all of this information about how things were done. That, you know, like, I did have a sense, and I think ultimately it served me well. It just, not initially. It wasn't. I did a book that's not horror at all. Is that actually was fortunate enough to be nominated for an Eisner for, called Feast of the Seven Fishes. It was a daily online comic strip, and it's a romantic comedy about, you know, Italians cooking fish on Christmas Eve. That strip really was a tremendous learning experience for me, because you had to do everything in 3 and 4 panels. And it started with a great young artist named Ed Pisker, and then about halfway through, Ed had to leave, and Alex Saviak came on. And Alex just, like, took me to school. He started really, and I do think when I came back and did things with you, there was a difference.
Oh,
then.
Yeah, yeah.
With, you know what I mean? Because you have to be so tightly controlled when you're, you know, because you have an, I had a bigger story in mind, but, you know, I was having to parse it out 3 and 4 panels a day, and it was...
That's really hard.
It really is, and I tell you, I would recommend it to anyone, especially if they were trying to, like, get into comics. I mean, just sit down and do them as exercises. It's, it made me a better comic writer. It made me a better screenwriter.
Alex had experience with that.
Oh, yeah.
Spider-Man for years.
Yeah.
So you're saying that breaking down sort of the writing and the whole process was harder for you than it was making a film? Because, I mean, I live in L.A. I mean, I know different people who are involved in different aspects of film. And, you know, I mean, the Hollywood is murder. So it's just, you're saying like the comic thing was harder for you to nail down in a way? Or
I'll put it this way. I've never not been able to make a decent living from film.
Oh.
Wow. So, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, I mean, you know, listen, you know, you wake up one day and you're that guy. You always hear about people who they make a living writing scripts that never get made. And I used to say, like, oh, yeah, right. No, well, it really happens.
Oh, wow.
So it really happens.
Oh, that's great. So and, that's good that you're able to do that. That's fantastic. So why don't we, let me ask you just how you got into horror. How did you develop a passion for horror? Where did that start off?
I think we both developed it the exact same way growing up.
Yeah, it's what I'm making that documentary about. It was this imagery, particularly in the early 60s through the late 70s. You know, you can look at all these different events that, you know, the horror hosts were a big part of our life. Dark Shadows. I think that I did that roundtable interview and video watchdog for Tim Lucas with a bunch of people talking about the old Dark Shadows TV show. And it is extraordinary in hindsight after coming out of that panel, out of that collaborative article at the end, and realizing I think it's underestimated how much that show affected young people.
Sure.
You know, and it was a great time to sort of come of age. You know, when I was a kid, not quite a teenager yet, all the big Marvel black and white horror books hit, and Tomb of Dracula hit, and Werewolf by Night, which was freaking awesome. I mean, all these, my gosh. You know, there was just so much wonderful stuff. A lot of times people will go, well, don't you want to mention EC or don't you want to mention Creepy and Eerie? And I want to go, listen, that's like me pretending that Jean-Luc Godard affected me. That's like when Tarantino, when people were talking about, you know, Orson Welles and this, and Tarantino's like, The Dirty Dozen and The Sound of Music, man, Gone with the Wind. Those are the things that affected us as kids. You know, Planet of the Apes was a huge influence, I think, on a generation of kids. There was all this imagery and stuff. It was a great time to be a kid.
Yeah. I'm a little older than Bob, so actually, like, say, for example, Dark Shadows was 66, wasn't it? Around that.
Yeah, I was too young for that.
I was 12 years old then. So that 10-year to 12-year time, I've looking back on it through the years, I've realized how much has influenced me and affected me in that little time period. The first Hammer film, which I love Hammer Films' work, first Hammer films I ever saw were Horror of Dracula and Curse of Frankenstein. They were at a drive-in in 1964.
Oh, wow.
And it was a double feature because they had just been re-released in America as a double feature. And my family took us in the station wagon, you know, my brother and I in our jammies, and I'm 10 years old, and we go to this, it was four films. It was Horror of Dracula, Curse of Frankenstein, Goliath versus the Vampires.
Oh, my gosh.
And Godzilla versus the Thing. So I guarantee you, all three of those major film genres affected the hell out of me for life. And the thing about the Hammer ones was I had seen on TV, of course, I'd seen the Universal stuff, and I loved them. But those Hammer films literally hammered me in the head.
Well, you know, it's funny. See, I got exposed to Hammer actually pretty much before Universal.
Yeah.
That stuff came in. I remember my brother and I stumbled upon Horror of Dracula one stormy day. It's like a total, honest to God, it's like such a stereotype, and just flipped out. You know, you're like 7 years old, and you're like, you know, I just remember my brother, you know, crying. I'm so scared.
That's really interesting because, I mean, do you remember, I mean, specifically what your first maybe horror film or experience would have been? And it sounds like it started really young because I know like kids today are not, well, I guess it depends, are not necessarily exposed to that stuff as easily or as readily as maybe you and I were growing up.
I think they're actually more exposed to it because of video and computers and such. When we were kids, you know, especially I think in my case, in many cases, is that, you know, television, you had maybe three channels if you were lucky.
Yeah.
And the movies you wanted to see came on occasionally, sometimes late at night. There was always commercials. They were cut up. You had to go out of your way to catch a movie back then. Or go to the theater to see them. And you didn't get re-releases all that often. And there was, of course, no video. So, but nowadays, kids can grab virtually any movie there is off of the internet, much less at a video store. Yeah. And I think it's easier now to be affected by those things. But I think because which might get a little pretentious, but as humans, we're hunters gatherers, you know. Mm-hmm. And back then, you had to hunt and gather to get the movies or the books
There were multiple holy grails. You know, I remember the one holy grail for me was Monster Times had this thing about this film that it was called Count Dracula by Jesus Franco yes. with Christopher Lee. And it was like, this is the film. and they did this thing, like Neil Adams did the promotional artwork. Stunning.
Yes.
I think heavily penciled, I think, more
it
than
all penciled.
It was all penciled. And it was like they did this poster. It was Christopher Lee behind bars. It said, "Free Count Dracula." And I just wanted to see this movie, and I wanted to see it so bad. And like for 5 years or 6 years, I couldn't see it. And it finally came on, and they ran it on Chiller Theater outside in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
They ran it, and it didn't come on until like 2 o'clock in the morning. And it was dreadful. I get motion sickness like with Blair Witch and stuff. It's all these awful zooms.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and
horrid music.
It's just terrible. And it's not, but man, it was like you had to see that movie.
And nowadays with the video, I mean, even that. I mean, I've got this beautiful print of it now on DVD of that movie. And the main reason to want it, of course, is, you know, because I'm a Christopher Lee geek.
Yeah.
And it's playing Dracula. But there was all that stuff wasn't available. Now it's almost too easy in some ways to get hold of some of that stuff.
Yeah, you miss the chase.
Yeah.
You know, it's like it's.
I think you actually the harder it is. It's like anything. Anticipation. It's the harder it is to get something you really want. The more you want it.
That's true.
And the easier it is to get. It kind of takes a little of the passion out of it, I think.
But you know, the funny thing is there is an echo to that. And I'm going to, this is like the bad segue, but I have to say it because it popped in my head. That's part of the reason that we're doing Flesh and Blood is there were things that we wanted that didn't happen.
Yeah.
And so we're trying to make them happen.
Well, sure. With Flesh and Blood, of course, Hammer being one of the primary influences, Hammer never did a crossover movie. They never had Baron Frankenstein meet Count Dracula or something like that.
Yeah.
And whether or not they ever thought, who knows if they ever thought of it, but they just never went ahead and did it. And we just said, duh, what heck, we did it with Black Forest.
Yeah, with Todd Livingston, we did it with, when Todd and I wrote the Black Forest, that was it. It was like, what if Universe, we did the thing we wanted to see happen.
And in those cases, I mean, they did do Monster Rally films in the old days, but with this, with Hammer, we said, heck, well they're not going to do it, so let's do it.
Although the funny thing is that you start to get a little frustrated. I mean, for sure you feel the influences of Hammer films. We'd be lying if we said we didn't. And particularly, you know, Terrence Fisher, who was a huge influence on both of us, the director, you know. But their influences on this strip honestly, as much as anything, Dracula Lives, that sensibility, even more from Dracula Lives than from Tomb of Dracula. But Tomb of Dracula is hugely important to both of us.
Yeah.
But other things, like, I mean, Neil's working on drawing Volume 3 right now, and, you know, Picnic in Hanging Rock.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. It's there. And it's not there. And again, and Tim Lucas has kind of helped me see this, although Tim didn't even, I don't think, realize it at first.
Yeah.
Dark Shadows was a giant monster rally.
Yeah,
and it was a tremendous influence on a lot of us. You know, like not so much Neil than it was me, but for sure. And let's be, you know, let's just be honest. Well, first of all, we put down soaps, but soaps are pretty rigorous medium. They work pretty, you know, soap operas. And you know, the best of comics function
they're
many ways
operas,
is soap operas. I mean, you know, I mean that was the genius of Spider-Man, that teen angst, that, you know, who's going to go in, will she go out with me, all that sort of stuff. That, you know, the other stuff is cool and it's around the edges, but, you know, I always think about it. I remember the moment it sort of became clear to me was like, I was young, I don't know, I might have been in junior high, and there was a Defenders comic book where I think it was like Egghead blew up his niece and she lost her arm and she broke up with Kyle Richmond with Nighthawk and they weren't going to date anymore. And it was like because she didn't feel like a complete person because she'd lost her arm. And it was, man, I felt like horrible. This is really cooler than when they fight.
Yes. Well, that's the whole aspect that draws you in. And actually, that's what I really like about Flesh and Blood is that it's not just sort of monsters. It's there's a story behind it. There's that whole, you know, heroes trying to track down the monsters and all the angst that kind of surrounds that a bit, you know.
Well, there's the whole thing about, you know, character and such, where, you know, it's like the Friday 13th movies, which are basically just, you know, just killing teenager movies. You'd probably like them a lot more if you cared about the teenagers they were killing.
Yeah.
And you don't.
Yeah.
Recently, Joss Whedon's Cabin in the Woods is a beautiful example of that, where you care actually for each and individual. When the first girl gets killed in the movie, I won't give anything else away, but it's painful. It literally is painful because you've gotten to like her in the story. And Flesh and Blood, it's the same thing. It would be one thing. We could do 4 issues of monsters fighting monsters. I mean, easily. But first of all, we'd be bored. Mm-hmm. And secondly, I think really the audience would be bored.
Sure.
You need those moments of the characters getting into the characters, into the storyline, and then you have these flashes of violence or flashes of action, and then you get back into it's. You have to have that up and down kind of feeling to it. Otherwise, you don't care.
And you know what else, Christian? That's going on. And again, you know, you always, when you talk about this stuff, you know, you can overanalyze or you start to overintellectualize or whatever. I mean, you know, we want to have fun. I mean, and it is fun. It's fun for us, and it seems to be fun for our audience. But also, I think that, you know, we are tapping back into the kind of roots of Gothic literature. And what's interesting, whereas, you know, like the Universal horror movies, they tapped into, like, German Expressionism. Mm-hmm. In a lot of ways, much more that than the true Gothic prototype. Whereas Hammer, you know, in those companies, and not just Hammer, actually, at that time, but they kind of went back more, they were more literary and less, in a sense, less visual. Yeah, if you know what I mean, like, because they didn't use the visual symbolism and whatnot. But what's great about that Gothic literature, you know, there's all this stuff that, you know, Mary Shelley was afraid of, that Bram Stoker was afraid of. You know, if you look at just Dracula, which I love the novel Dracula, and you know, you look at all the different anxieties that are present there, from very simple biological ones, you know, like fluids, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And sort of parallels for STDs. And, you know, and you think about Bram Stoker being in the city and suddenly it's opening up, and there's, you know, when you're going to the docks in London, you're hearing all these different languages and voices and music and sounds and you know, and foods and smells. And it must have been very threatening, especially to an island nation. And then you've got women starting to, oh my God, they want to have jobs. You know, next thing you know, they're going to demand an orgasm. I mean, oh my God, you know, what are we going to do? And, you know, so all of those elements, it's funny. If you look at Flesh and Blood on the surface, you're like, oh man, they've got a lot of really hot girls without very many clothes on. But the truth is, for both of us, it's looking at these women who are struggling to be empowered, and how much it threatens the men. A lot of things that happen in these books happen not for a supernatural reason, but because the men can't deal
with
the women exercising power or control. Whatever.
Well, that's what one thing that I've noticed, especially now on the third issue, is though Baron Frankenstein is in essence the star of the series, there's a huge feminine element to the entire series that mm-hmm. Bob has put in there with the characters. Aside from the obvious, like you're saying, like it opens with, you know, naked lesbian vampires, you know, on top of each other, it develops into a whole other thing. This third issue is primarily about a young girl who's kind of, I won't give anything away other than that, but she's a young girl who has lost her memory. Frankenstein has experimented on her for some reason. And she meets all these other young girls who are in a finishing school, which is where the kind of picnic and hanging rock thing comes in. And there is some interesting, fascinating, emotional stuff that develops during the course of the story that naturally leads to some horrible, tragic things in the book. But it's very much it's almost a breather in the series.
Uh-huh.
It's you know, we've had 2 issues of vampires and Dracula and werewolves fighting each other, and now we have this kind of poignant character tale about this young woman and how she's all screwed up because of what Frankenstein has done. And it's very much, there's a lot of feminine stuff going on in this series.
Well, yeah, that's one of the things that I wanted to ask you guys about, because in this book, you don't necessarily, at least the first 2 issues, it doesn't seem like you guys are holding back at all. Like, you are doing things that, I mean, although Hammer tended to be, you know, a bit salacious in some of their productions, and I mean, you guys go all out in certain aspects of this book. And so when was the decision made to say, like, we're just going to go even further than the films probably even could? Like, we're just going to go all the way with it.
I don't think we'd actually have gone farther than the films. I think the way I always refer to it is it's kind of a soft R from like the early 70s, the way Hammer was going. They did Vampire Lovers and Lust for a Vampire, and we haven't really done anything beyond what they actually did in those movies. I mean, it might seem that way because, again, you're looking at drawings.
I think what it is, Christian, I think it's because contextually now, it's every element of what made Gothic horror great, you know, that's sort of coming together. You know, I go back, I tell you, a strong influence on me, and I go back again, I just saw someone else did another film version of it, is Wuthering Heights.
Yeah.
You know, the great love story. It's not a great love story. That's a sick story.
Yeah, it's depressing.
It's awesome. It's depressing. There's all kinds of weird sexual shit going on. I'm sorry, can I say that on the show? Yeah, I get to get it.
Yeah, you can say it.
Underneath, right? You know what I mean? Like, there's implied incest. And that is really, you know, informing, I think, what we're doing a lot, too. Not just Wuthering Heights, I mean. But I think, I will say this, sometimes early on, Neil would, I gotta say, he would flip me a page and I go, wow, that's not exactly what I thought was gonna happen. You know? I didn't know you were gonna go for it. And he's like, you know what, if we're gonna do this, we're gonna do this. You know, and the more we thought about it, because we had a terrible title, I won't even say what it originally was, because we couldn't think
of
the title.
Come on.
And then, you know, my friend Ted had done the Hammer documentary, Flesh and Blood, and I'd helped him with that. And I was like, I kept thinking about it, and that's really what this book is about. It's about the flesh.
Very much.
It's about the blood, and it's kind of about all this sort of mingling of the two in every aspect. I mean, one of the things that I'm really proud of in the second book is when Frankenstein, because, you know, Frankenstein, all he has is his curiosity, really, and the occasional bout of lust. I mean, Beyond that, he really doesn't have anything else. And, you know, and he, as you know, he ends up becoming sexually active,
yes,
with a vampire,
yes.
But again, it's not about, you know, he's just horny. It's because he is curious about how do vampires do it, you know.
Yeah,
something that we're all curious about, really, right?
I mean, well, here's the thing. Because here's the deal. If you really start thinking about it, and you really want to have fun doing this stuff, then you start to think about what motivates them.
Yeah,
and I will go back to one of the things I will credit. You know, when you write screenplays, you're developing things with different companies in Hollywood. You know, people are always talking about raising the stakes, and a character in the movies anymore. You know, when you're writing screenplays, they can't just be evil. They have to want something. That's what Hollywood says. They got to want something.
Yeah,
and I used to really resent that. I'm really glad that people pushed me to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because then it becomes, what do they want? You know, and as you know, Erzabet in Flesh and Blood 2, she kind of talks about it. She, you know, basically, she doesn't say it in so many words, but it's like, what do you think, I'm a cockroach?
Uh-huh.
You know, they have a small brain. I mean, these aren't zombie. These aren't the flesh-eating zombies or something like this, or reanimated corpses. I mean, they're dead people who are reanimated, but they're cognizant of their reanimation. And yeah. And it goes back. First, I had written a thing that eventually we're going to fold. I'd written something called Only at Night, which will actually eventually be folded into the Flesh and Blood storyline far down the road. But there was a moment in it, you know, that I realized what sort of Terry Fisher was exploring, which is the kind of duality, this you know, white, black, good, evil, you know, Christ, Antichrist, all these sort of opposites. And one of the things I thought of was like, well, if suicide is a mortal sin, if a vampire commits suicide, is that in fact a holy act, right? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Start thinking about that. If they consciously would choose death, true death over that, you know, and it starts getting into all this kind of really neat theological, philosophical, whatever stuff. It's just flat out fun to think about.
Yeah. I mean, that's the interesting, and I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but the thing that's kind of never been made clear to me, except for maybe like on something like Buffy the Vampire Slayer or the Joss Whedon sort of universe, is like what actually does happen to someone when they become a vampire. I mean, you're talking about a cognizant creature, but how different is it than what you were before you got turned, right?
Right.
Well, it's
right.
There's an inherent sort of problem with it because of free will. If you buy into the Judeo-Christian thing of, you know, you've removed free will, it actually is counterintuitive to what, you know, it's like punishing someone because they have a, you know, an STD or AIDS or something, you know what I mean, like, mm-hmm. as if there was some, you know, reason, you know, some sort of inherent moral failing if you were attacked and something bad happened to you and you got sick from it. I mean, it's illogical.
Well, with Wiedemann, he made the point at the beginning that a vampire loses its soul. It doesn't have its soul anymore. And that's what makes them evil creatures in a way. And that he introduced that character of Angel as a character who's a vampire whose soul had been returned to him so he would suffer eternally for all the horrible things he's done.
Yeah.
And then the worst tragedy would be that if he ever had total happiness, which is what he accomplishes with Buffy, that he would turn back to his evil self again. So it was a lose-lose situation for him.
Yeah.
He either suffered from all the memories of killing, or he became his evil self again. And what is he going to do? He's going to go through eternity that way.
Yeah, yeah, which I thought was kind of a brilliant take on that sort of like little universe. But so just, I guess, one last thing. How did you guys end up hooking up with MonsterVerse? How did you guys, you know, get involved working all together? I mean, I know you guys said how you guys met, but how did you meet up with, you know, the guys behind MonsterVerse?
Well, we're friends. Bob's actually better friends with Kerry Gamble.
Yeah.
Who is a well-known comic book artist himself.
Mm-hmm.
And it's essentially his company. He's behind a lot of this. He's one of the few people that actually works at the company. And Sam Park, who does a lot of the PR and such. And I think Bob had probably been in touch with Kerry.
No, it was you. I told Neil, I said, don't bother, because they're busy with Lugosi, and I don't think they're going to want to deal with
this. They wanted to do an anthology book called Bela Lugosi's Tales from the Grave.
Yeah, which is fantastic.
They had gotten the rights from Lugosi Jr. to do that, to use Lugosi as kind of an Uncle Creepy kind of character in the book.
Uh-huh.
And I had seen that, and I'd only known Kerry through online. I've never actually met the guy. And I had written him an email. I just said, Kerry, I'd love to do a story in that sometime. Maybe Bob and I could do a story there and for one of the issues. And he said, sure, we'd love it. And just one thing led to another. Bob and I didn't get to do a story together. I did do a story in the second issue, but we started talking about other stuff. And at the time, we had already been working in some fashion on Flesh and Blood. Probably at the time, it still wasn't even called Flesh and Blood. Mm-hmm. And I had done a lot of pages on it at that point. At that point, it was one book. We were going to do just one graphic novel at the time. And I started showing some of the pages on Facebook, and Kerry started seeing these pages. He said, oh, I love these pages. These are great. What is this? And one thing led to another. I explained it to him, and he said, you know, guys, this is the kind of book we want to do. And that's kind of got it started.
Oh, wow.
Kerry and Sam are fantastic. But you can't, and I can't minimize what they've done. For example, early on, Kerry he designed the logo, but he was like, we want Dan Brereton to do the covers. And Neil and I, we had another idea, to be blunt.
Yes.
Another way that we thought the covers were going to be. But when I saw which we were involved with the design of the cover,
yeah.
I mean, it was a team effort, don't get me wrong, because Dan's like, just tell me what you want. When I saw that first cover, I went, oh, my God. You know what? Now on, when Kerry says just do something, I'm pretty much just going to do it.
Yeah.
And just, you know, and the other thing I would say, too, is that I think that comics, given the costs, need to deliver more,
mm-hmm.
given their competition. And we really strive for a few things. We want to pack that book cover to cover with entertainment. And we also want to do, like, the way that comics and monster magazines and fanzines and things in the 60s and 70s did, you felt like you were in a clubhouse.
Yeah.
And we're really trying to create that sense of community. That's why we have our friends come in, like Michael Price is writing something for the third volume. It's going to be great. Tom Savini's doing something for the third volume. Adam Hughes just did something for us. Tim Lucas. But also great, you know, we're lucky on our backups. I mean, Bob Hall, I'm writing something for Bob Hall. I'm ecstatic doing that Operation Satan thing, which will eventually feed into the main Flesh and Blood storyline.
Yeah. Really?
And then, yes.
How? Oh, well, obviously you can't tell me.
It's kind of we're just kind of creating our own Flesh and Blood universe.
Oh, that's great. Because I like Operation Satan a lot.
Yeah, and Bob he's a neglected artist. I mean, he's one of those fellows that's been in the industry for ages, and his work is amazing. I mean, to this day, and he's older than I, he's a good 10 years, maybe 10 years older than me.
Oh, really?
And so he's in his 60s, and he just draws beautifully, but he's just not, because you get to, it's an age thing with comic.
Well, but he also went off and wanted to do other things.
He does theater.
Yeah, he directs. I mean, this guy's a renaissance man, but he's taking me to graduate school. That's what I keep saying.
And we also, we had our old British buddy, Aid Salmon, that was doing a Frankenstein thing for us. And we've got wonderful artists doing pinups, and we've got a lot of friends of ours doing text pieces, which are, they've kind of fill in the gaps of a lot of this stuff. It's like we call it DVD extras sometimes, you know.
We want there to be conversation, and I do think, you know, like what Bruce Hallenbeck did in the first book, he did that little backstory, and then Kurt Purcell did one in the last one, and I'm hearing from like younger readers, you know, like we're getting some girls reading now, for example, and some girls in their early 20s told me that they really appreciated that they would read the story and then they read the extras and they go, oh, I got to go back and read the story again because now that I have some context or I have a deeper understanding, a deeper appreciation for it, I love that. And you remember when Tony Isabella would write articles for Dracula Lives or something back in the day? Like those things, they just made you feel more, I don't know, aware. And it just, anytime you can increase appreciation and understanding, I think that it becomes a richer reading experience.
What was great
experience.
Is that eventually Tony gave us a great review of the book, too.
Yeah, Tony gave us a great review.
So we got a nice geek moment out of that.
That's great. Well, I got to say, I mean, I do love this book, and I think it's quality all the way through. I mean, it's just fantastic. I picked up the first two at Comic-Con, and I can't, you know, say enough about it. So I think you guys are doing a great job. When does the third one come out?
I just yelled across the convention today. They said we were at the West Virginia Pop Culture Con today, and I'm like, "Yeah, when is number three coming out?"
I said, "As soon as the artist is done with it."
Gotcha.
I'm writing four now, and you know what we did? We were idiots. I got to say this: Neil and I both fully consider Matt Webb to be a
The colorist.
He is a storyteller on this book, and to suggest otherwise or to ignore his contributions would just be
criminal. And he's got two big things going against him at the beginning because, first of all, he's doing it for nothing. He's just not getting paid. He's doing it for the passion of doing it.
Wow.
And second, as are the rest of us, for that matter. But he's also, he didn't really know the source material that well that we were kind of referencing. Oh. So I had to give him a lot of movies and stills and things to get him going, and he just fell right into it. After, as he put it, he said after that first half of the first issue, he just fell right into it. And everybody that reviews the book comments on his colors.
Yeah, no, I mean, and they're unsung heroes, especially these days with everything being sort of digital and stuff like that. The colorists are really the unsung heroes of the comic book industry, in my opinion.
Well, if you watch, he's been... what I like is that he and Neil both have been sort of shifting some things as they go on. And hey, Kristen, you don't have to put this in the interview, but I got to ask you because what we both decided is we're going to play with things. We're going to do what we want to do.
Yeah.
Have fun and push the form a little bit. And I keep getting these private messages from people going, did you really just jump that book 50 years in the future?
Yes. Yeah.
And by the way, it will happen again.
And the thing is, it's really, if it's paying attention, it's easy. It's a smooth transition. Even though it's 50 years, it's a smooth transition.
Yeah, I definitely, when I was reading that, I had to go back and forth, and I was like, wait, what just happened here? Hold on. And then, you know, because there wasn't really, I have the book here, and I can flip to it, but I don't remember if there was anything that, I just had to go back and forth and say, wait a minute, what just happened here? Did they just jump ahead? Either way.
And honestly, we wanted that reaction because it made people stop and go, holy cow. You know, it was that jump the shark moment. So you can't do that. You know, and so that was why we wanted to do it. And for me particularly, you know, writing screenplays where you just kind of have so many rules, to the opportunity here to actually be a comic book and break some rules and have some fun.
Yeah.
It's just wonderful.
And that's the primary thing. We're having a lot of fun doing it.
Well, you can tell that you guys are having fun. I think that, every page is just full of passion, and especially your art. I mean, I just think it's absolutely fantastic. And like I said, I loved it from the moment I picked it up. So there's no firm release date on three. Are these just, there's no like set deadline or like schedule, or three just comes out when it comes out?
That was a fault of ours when we started. We really should have, ideally looking back on it, we should have started putting the book out after having at least finished two issues, which we did not do. We kind of jumped into publishing the book right in the middle of doing like the first issue.
Yeah.
Then we had to rearrange our idea. Like I said, it was a one book. And then we had this banging of heads at Pittsburgh one year, and we said, no, we can't do it. It's not going to work. Matt was busy on something else. We're never going to get it done. And by the schedule we wanted, so we said, well, maybe we need to expand it. No, we can't do that. We can't. And then he thought about it more, and he said, let's expand it to a 4-book series. And then not only could we make it work that way, but he could add that much more to the storyline.
And then it got crazy.
And then it got crazy because once the book started coming out, it was like, oh, God, now I got to catch up.
Yeah.
I'm still trying to catch up.
Well, yeah. The other thing that we realized, though, is that people are not content. They don't want this all squeezed in. The readership isn't enormous yet, but they are passionate, they're vociferous, and they want what they want, and they don't want this rushed. And when we realize that, you know, it's like you get that pat on the head, and you're like, well, fine. Then we won't rush it.
Yeah.
And we'll do the things that we want to do. And we have a lot of plans. I mean, I hope and pray that 10 years from now we're doing this book. And you can say, well, and believe me, where we're planning on going will probably really surprise you. But I don't want to really get into it. But the only change we're talking about making is possibly after book 4. And maybe we won't even wait till then. We're talking about maybe so we could come out more often, dropping it to being like a 48 or 56 page book,
please,
that could come out every 2 or 3 months, you know. Gotcha. So we could keep the conversation going, and we're having some talks about that, and we could do that.
Oh, assuming we actually get to continue the book for the foreseeable future, the ideal thing is that even though we've jumped around a lot of time, we've got all of that story that we could still return to down the line.
Sure.
We could go into that 50-year period and examine that more closely if we ever got around to that point.
Yeah.
So it's just so much. I mean, once Bob gets going on an idea, he's done this before with Black Forest and with Wicked West. Once he gets the idea going, suddenly he's finding this avenue to go to and that path to take and this door to go through. And it starts leading to hundreds of stories that you could do, potentially.
Yeah, that's great. So, I mean, it seems like, did you have any challenges releasing it in this format, like $14.99 for like a very good quality book, but were there any, did anyone push back on that and say like, no, it should be 22 pages, blah, 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 you know?
I mean, you know, there's certainly some retailer apathy in certain regions of the country, not on the coast. I mean, on the coast, we got a lot of support. But I get it. You know, if I'm a small retailer in a little, like, town of, you know, but, you know, where I live in West Virginia, my friend and retailer, you know, in a tiny little comic shop in a small town, you know, he's pushed dozens of copies because he gets out and he sells it. But, you know, these guys have to lay cash. I get it. You know, we're not going to complain about them. We keep saying we're going to sell it one person at a time. And it hasn't been so much pushback as it is people are saying, please come out more often.
Yes.
Please come out more often.
Yeah. And ideally, we would love to do that.
Yeah, yeah. We're going to get to that point, but we have to do what we have to do.
But Neil's an old guy, and it takes him a long time.
Well, that's great, and I appreciate your time, and thanks for doing this. And, you know, I know you guys have had a full weekend of a con, so you must be exhausted. So
this is fun, though. We enjoy this.
Doing fine.